The views expressed on this podcast are only those of the individuals featured on the show and do not in any way reflect the official policy of the United States government.
You are listening to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. We believe wealth isn't just about finances and money. It includes health, relationships, and anything else that makes you excited to get up in the morning. We interview members of the foreign affairs community to see how they're building wealth, both personally and financially, no matter where they're posted. This is your host, Tanya Salsa. Let's get to today's show. Welcome to the Embassy Wealth Podcast. I'm here today with Mike Warder. And Mike has a very interesting story. In 2006, he bought his first condo in Denver, not really thinking he would become a real estate investor, and then took a really huge pause until he bought his next property in 2016. And during that time, you know, he joined the department, he was in the civil service and then the foreign service, and then really started investing, you know, once 2016 hit and has been investing ever since. And one of the really interesting pieces, I think, of what Mike is doing compared to other investors that I know that invest in real estate is something I like to call DIY landlording, which we'll get into, which is essentially that Mike manages his properties as a landlord from overseas. And he'll talk a little bit more about that as we get into the conversation. Welcome to the show, Mike.
Hey, Tanya. So happy to join you. Thanks for having me on.
Yeah, I've been wanting to have you on for a while. I know you've got a lot of wealth and nuggets to share with our listeners. So why don't we start at the beginning? So you bought this condo in 2006 in Denver. I mean, did you mean for it to be an investment? What was kind of the start to your story?
I had no idea what I was doing. I was just starting law school and I was looking at places to rent apartments and I thought they were pretty expensive. And I looked online and kind of found out that a mortgage on a small apartment in Denver was going to be cheaper than rent on an apartment. And so I kind of started to go down that road and, you know, I had no income, no job, no assets, but in 2006, that wasn't a problem. So I ended up finding an apartment and it's crazy to say, I got it for $50,000. I put 5% down. Unbelievable. I mean, looking back, I mean, I'd do that, you know, all day if I could.
Was the neighborhood okay? I mean, where were you living? I mean, was it habitable at 50,000?
So this discussion about this, it was, you know, my wife has, we have debates about this, but I lived there for 2 years and it was totally fine for me. It was next door to like a kid's daycare school. So there wasn't too much nefarious stuff going on. There may have been, I mean, it was a large apartment complex with, you know, maybe 150 units. Spread out. It was like three stories max. So it was pretty spread out. But there was some people doing some shady things in other buildings, but it never really affected me. And so when I bought the property, it was a time when there were still some foreclosures and they were, but it was like new and the banks were still doing the lipstick, you know, foreclosures where they would put paint on the walls and do carpets. And so I didn't even know it was a foreclosure. I wouldn't have been able to tell you what a foreclosure was, but it was in my price range. The area was close to school and it was a 2-bedroom. I said, let's do it. And so $50,000, it got me. I sold my motorcycle. I had no money for closing costs. So we rolled $4,000 worth of closing costs into the $50,000 loan. I put $2,700 down. I was sad to see my motorcycle go, but you know, I knew I just had this idea in the back of my mind, like, you know, okay, it's a good idea. I literally, for the entirety of law school, I paid my student, my mortgage with student loans.
Oh,
And then following law school, it's the great financial crisis, 2008, 2009. What I began to do was I was going to sell. I didn't know there was anything to do with properties other than sell. That was just kind of what I saw growing up. And I went to Zillow. I remember this. There's one day I went to Zillow and I looked up just to see what the value of the property was. And with the crisis and everything, it had chopped so much. It was in the 20s, like 20 something thousand. And I shut the Zillow webpage down. It's like, don't ever do that again. But I was stuck because there's no way I could have afforded to pay the balance of the mortgage. So I started Googling around trying to figure out like, what do people do in this situation? And then came across this idea that property management companies can, you know, handle your properties and rent them out. So this property, actually, it worked out well for me. I went through law school. I lived there. There's no problems. But the problem I did encounter was right around the time I was ready to leave law school. It's 2008, 2009, which is like right in the midst of the great financial crisis, where housing prices totally tanked. And so I was kind of stuck because I just assumed that when you are leaving to go somewhere else, which I was doing, you sold the property. And that was the only option. And I logged onto Zillow one day to just see like what the value of the property was. And it was in the 20s. Like it was super scary. I just shut down the window and was like, don't you ever look at Zillow again. And I was like, okay, I need a plan B or a plan A or something. So I Googled around and I found out that there's these things called property management companies that would kind of manage a property if you're kind of, going away, and which was what I was doing. And I did the absolute wrong thing, which is I just Googled property management companies in Denver. And then I picked the first one. And I came to that with a mindset of, oh, please save me. And of course, there's zero due diligence on my part. And that began a long string of, both mistakes, but then also successes, in real estate along the way. But so I left that property in 2008 and we rented it out through 2017. And while it was down in like the 20,000s at one point, it recovered and then surpassed, far surpassed what I had purchased it for, and then was able to use that money to purchase another property in Alexandria, Virginia.
Okay, so you sell your Denver, Colorado condo, and then how does that lead you to Alexandria exactly?
Well, so the money that the proceeds from the sale in Colorado, I had to figure out what I was going to do with it. I didn't want to, I didn't want to pay taxes on it. Nobody wants to pay taxes, right? But I didn't want to pay taxes on the gains. So I did what's called a 1031 exchange, which is, a mechanism through which you can defer paying taxes, which means you can have more money to spend on like properties or similar properties. Mm-hmm. So I had purchased previously a couple properties in South Carolina, but I was looking to bring some of those funds closer to where I had been living, which is the Washington, D.C. area, where mm-hmm. I had some familiarity. Alexandria was a fantastic place. I found that there were some properties there that weren't just amazingly like out of reach, that if I rented out, I could probably make my money back. And one of the things I knew about the DC area is that appreciation there is generally pretty good. There's a long history of price appreciation in Northern Virginia that outpaces, the national average. It's not immune to all economic issues, but generally speaking, looking back, Arlington and Northern Virginia, Alexandria, they do very well. So I wanted to park my money in a place that made sense financially, that was kind of safe, but I could also get a little bit of money from the rental side of things, but also see that appreciation.
And what year did you purchase the Alexandria property?
So that was 2017.
Okay, so you hung on to that initial condo for about, 11 years, it sounds like? I mean, and what were the numbers when you finally sold this $50,000 place?
Yeah, so we bought it for $50,000. I put $2,700 down. We sold it for, I think, $120,000 or just shy of that.
Wow, $2,700 down? And no, those are some great numbers, right? I mean, and like not even trying, right? You kind of just stumbled into it. So that's quite a story. And I find it interesting that you rolled that money into Alexandria, Virginia, because a lot of people would say, oh, well, what's the point? Like, you're never going to get any cash flow. It's so expensive in Northern Virginia. I mean, that was 2017. So we're not talking about, 2022. But I mean, would you purchase in Alexandria again today? And if so, why or why not?
That's a good question. I think I'd be a little bit more careful in what I did purchase. Everybody's very worried about, the cost of housing today. I mean, we've all seen it. Those of us who own properties, you can get excited for like a half second. You're like, oh my gosh, my portfolio, like it's gone up. And, but then at the same time, it's like, well, great. Now, if you have capital to deploy, things are expensive. So I think I still would. And one of the reasons is that if you look at you can't just look at the costs of homes. And so one of the things I think it's really important to take into consideration is interest rates. Interest rates continue to be at historical lows. I think mm-hmm. the long-term average rates are like 7% interest rates for mortgages, and people forget that. And when I was a little kid, my parents bought a home in Clinton, Maryland. It was like $75,000, $500 down. And
crazy.
It was 15% interest.
Oh.
And if you do the math, the monthly payment on that isn't that different from what you might see today. And the reason is because the interest rate has such an outsized impact on mm-hmm. your monthly payment. So, mm-hmm. so I don't want to just discount all properties because of the purchase price, even if it is high. What I want to do is also look at interest rates, but then also wages. And that's important because whenever you're purchasing a property, the lender is going to look at your debt to income. You know, how much of your monthly income are you going to spend on this property? And, you know, if you look at the affordability of properties today, you know, we're looking at low 20% of the average monthly income nationwide. Low 20% is dedicated to mortgages these days. And it's because of the low interest rates, even if the prices have gone up. So I think it's too simplistic to just look at the purchase price. And you kind of have to look at some other factors as well.
I agree. You know, there's a lot that goes into the numbers for real estate. I mean, purchase price is only one of those numbers, right? But the interest rates have a huge, huge impact. I think you're absolutely right. And I mean, the interesting thing I think about what you're saying is that, you know, a lot of listeners have their own experiences with the housing market in the DC area because there, you know, lots of people are coming in and out of here all the time. And I think there would be quite a few listeners who would disagree that, you know, things are affordable in the DC market, right? So, I mean, I guess if you're looking at it and compared to, you know, a percentage of your overall income that you're spending on housing, perhaps, but you think that's really the case in the DC area? I mean, you said you'd buy in Alexandria again. What would you say to those listeners who say DC is totally unaffordable? Like I would never buy there.
So I'm reminded of when we bought a home in Arlington in 2017. And the seller was an original owner, or not original, but they had owned it for like 30 years. So mm-hmm. they had bought it a long time before, and you know, a nice old couple. But I remember the seller said that when he bought the property for like $130,000,
crazy.
He was like, it was a stretch, and it was like tough, and it was super expensive. But they just felt right, and so that's super tough. Like, because you feel like you're stretching, and like it's, you have to look at it in context. And so, but if you look forward. You know, again, Arlington in Northern Virginia has a history of appreciation. I was looking back at the appreciation of properties in the area going back to like 1977. And so that's like 45 years. And there's only 5 years of those 45 years in which we saw negative appreciation, where housing median sales value went down. And in three of those years, it was like less than 1%. It was like negligible. Mm-hmm. And the 2 years where it went down in any, you know, considerable amount was like 2008 and 2009, mm-hmm. right around the financial crisis, where we saw downturns all across the country.
Exactly. You know,
in some places.
Yeah, even DC's not immune. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, but even still, Northern Virginia, they went down 14%. And then I think 6.5% the next year in 2009. Mm-hmm. And then they recovered. And you know, some areas of the country are just getting back to those old, you know, values they had back in 2008, you know, when the prices plummeted. So Arlington, and I looked back, it was something like 5.6% appreciation average. Mm-hmm. Arlington and Alexandria over the last 45 years. So again, compared to like that national average, Arlington is still a strong bet for a good place to put your money to see those outsized gains in the long term.
And it's interesting because I feel like you've had experience on both sides of the real estate, you know, spectrum, like buying, you know, a single family home in Arlington, which is not, you know, all that cheap. And you bought like a $50,000 kind of starter condo, and you've, you know, seen a bunch of stuff in between. And I think what's interesting too about like what you're saying in terms of like the larger expensive homes, because I hear it all the time, obviously, as an agent, and, you know, most people that are trying to buy in the DC area and in Northern Virginia and even, you know, the Maryland suburbs, every single person is saying, wow, this is expensive, right? Like, oh my God. And it's interesting to hear that older couple that bought when, you know, it was 130,000 or whatever it was, we're saying the same thing, because I feel like everybody I've talked to, whether they buy now, 5 years ago, 10 years ago, 20 years ago, it was a stretch for them too. But once they got in, like you say, there's outsized gains as long as you're willing to sit on it for a while, right? I mean, you can't sell it in like 1 or 2 years and expect that you're going to make a bunch of money. But I know in my experience, I've owned 3 homes in Arlington. I still have one that I have. And they beat the pants off of smaller cash flow properties that are, you know, cash flowing $100 or $200 a door. So, you know, you get appreciation of $100 or $200K, you know, and that's not always typical. But if you look at what the right property is, and if it's, and I don't know if you have some thoughts on this too, Mike, but I always try to look at what sort of the average price, can I get a little bit of below average, and can I slowly polish it over time? Because I get stuff that's unloved and a little beat up. And that has been a winning formula for me in kind of more expensive markets like DC. Do you do something similar, or what would you advise for people who are looking at something like, let's say, in the Northern Virginia area that they're looking for appreciation?
Yeah. So right now is a really difficult time just because those properties that typically need a little bit of love, people are willing to just throw money at it and deal with, the upgrades later on. So, it puts people in a difficult spot. I mean, these are not, cheap homes.
No.
And there's a reason why the government backs our ability to leverage into these things throughout the country. So I think anybody who's looking at properties and even the Arlington area. So one of the big mistakes I made early on just in my thinking was that it wasn't possible to invest in the area. And I think the better way to put it was I didn't know how to invest in the area. I didn't understand the market. Mm-hmm. Whereas in maybe South Carolina or maybe the Denver property, I understood cash flow. But I didn't understand the appreciation aspect of it. And I probably wouldn't recommend people to only buy homes that they want to appreciate, because you do have to pay the monthly bills. But what I've ended up doing is I happen to have properties that are a little bit more on the appreciation side, some that are just, not going to appreciate at all or not that much, but, they bring in some good cash to make me feel comfortable each month. So if you can kind of balance that out to where you feel comfortable, I think that's probably a good way to do it.
So talk to us a little bit about what your portfolio looks like today and kind of, some of the moves that you've made in terms of buying and selling. Because I know you own in quite a few states. You're in Maryland, in Virginia, you're in South Carolina, you're in Colorado. Tell us a little bit about, how you assembled your portfolio and what was your philosophy behind it.
Sure. I mean, I don't have a lot of properties. I'm not like the guy who 3 weeks ago was living in a van down by the river and then all of a sudden has like 5,000 properties worth $10 gajillion. Mm-hmm. And that kind of story always turns me off. So in 2016, I purchased a couple properties in South Carolina. The idea was trying to move my resources to a place where I thought, there was appreciation. The demographic showed there's a lot of people moving there. I also happen to have like a lot of anecdotal stories of people I knew moving there. Mm-hmm. So it just supported this idea of, okay, this place is booming. The inventory in the area wasn't good enough to support it long term. The prices, if you look if you're used to the DC area, you look anywhere else and
everything seems cheap. Yes.
Yeah. And I found a place in South Carolina in Charleston, and it was a townhome. It's beautiful. I still own it today. I got it for $105,000.
Seems nuts.
It's for $1,300 or whatever it is. By some people's metrics, that's not an amazing deal. But for me, and I think by 2022 standards, it's pretty decent.
It's very good.
Mm-hmm. I'm super happy with it because it has appreciated in value because there is low inventory in the area and people continue to move there. And it still pulls in several hundred dollars of cash flow a month, which allows me to have some more flexibility, with whatever else I'm doing with my finances. And I picked up another property in the area just because I got to know the area. You spend a lot of time trying to understand a metropolitan market and you don't want all that to go to waste. So we purchased another property in there, very similar, a single family home, roughly the same. It was actually a little bit more. We offloaded it last year. It just, honestly, if we're being straight with ourselves, it wasn't performing like the other one. Mm-hmm. And I made some mistakes. One of those mistakes was not calculating the property taxes correctly. And so that ate into some of my cash flow. And so I had it for 5 years and we just decided to offload it. It wasn't performing. It had appreciated in value because of the market we're in. And I thought, well, let's just go ahead, cut our losses. I didn't lose any money cash flow wise, but I was able to realize some gains just because of the price appreciation. And so it was a long saga of trying to sell it, but we got rid of that last month. So we're down to one property in South Carolina.
Nice. And for those of you who don't know, for the listeners, so Mike and I actually, he found a property, I will say, and he did all the work on it in South Carolina and then decided he wanted to buy his house in Arlington. And then he was like, well, I don't think I want this deal. And I took a look at it. I'm like, this is a great deal. I'll buy it. So actually, thank you very much, Mike. I appreciate that. Do you want to talk to us about how you found that? Because did you even see any of these properties in person? I don't think you did you?
So the five properties that we had, well, four now, but I've only set foot in one of them ever. So I think an older version of myself would have thought, That's super weird. But nowadays, I think it's actually super normal. And it's actually better because, you know, the moment you start setting foot into a place, you get a little bit, you know, emotionally, not emotionally attached, not in that way, but just like you start seeing things a little bit differently. And it's a little bit easier to look at things from a numbers perspective when you're from afar. Now, I would obviously never purchase a property without having somebody I trust go in there. But so it's like that other property that you picked up. I still think about that property.
It was a great property. I mean,
so I bought the other two properties. Mm-hmm. I had a property manager in place. I was like, I kind of know the area and it's exactly where I wanted to buy, great schools. And it was like, I kept seeing it on these like online just for sale. I've been sitting there for like 6 or 9 months or something. And it was a short sale. And I was deterred because it was a short sale, just like everyone else. But I finally just one day I remember I was at a gym and I was like on a treadmill or something and I just got sick of looking at that thing. And so I got off the treadmill and I just contacted the agent. It's like, what's the deal with this house? And the listing agent said, look, it's a fine house. It just, it fell through escrow and an inspection report said something about the foundation and everybody got scared. And so nobody wanted to go near it. And so this is really interesting going back to your point about, you know, fixer uppers and stuff. This house was in pretty good condition. It wasn't in good enough condition for like a first time home buyer, mm-hmm. but it was in way too good condition for like a major rehabber to go in there. There wasn't enough meat on the bone. Mm-hmm. So this thing had been previously approved in a short sale for like $123,000. It was probably worth like $145,000, $150,000 maybe. And so I talked to the agent and I said, look, I'll put in an offer at $105,000. I had $105,000 stuck in my mind because that other property purchased for some reason. I had heard short sales take forever. And so I was like, okay, let me go do some other real estate stuff. And I was thinking like 9 months before like the bank comes back and approves it. And so I was going to deploy capital elsewhere. And then they came back in like 4 weeks and like, okay, we're ready to close. And I was like, whoa, I've kind of already signed another contract. And so it just, you know, the timing didn't work out, but I was super happy that you were around and you were interested and it turned out, I mean, I don't know the final numbers. Maybe you would know. But of course
I
you should
do know. No, and I did purchase actually for $105,000 cash.
Nice.
And I this is the benefit of networking, right? Like if you, for those listeners, I think it's really important to like talk to other people in the real estate space because I would have never found this deal or even thought about South Carolina if, you know, I didn't know Mike. And, you know, he already had properties there. He had a really good property management company, which is very key. And he had done all the work on it too. Like he had the inspection reports. He already had the property manager go out there to like say, hey, here's the things that need to get done after closing. And they had this plan in place and it was just, you know, Mike decided to deploy his funds elsewhere. I said, you know, looks like a deal to me. So I purchased for $105,000. I think I probably spent about close to $10,000 in work because it needed, you know, a few things. And so I was in for about, you know, $115,000. And then, you know, I waited the 6 months, which is sort of the seasoning requirement for when you go to do a cash out refinance, right? So, because otherwise, if you do it less than 6 months, they go by the purchase price, which would have been 105. So by that time, you know, we had gotten tenants in there, the property management company was managing it. And the refinance, when I went to go do it, they did the appraisal and it came back at 160. I was like, oh, well, fantastic. So, you know, I think if I remember correctly, I mean, basically I got all of my money back out in the cash out refi. So I was into that property for zero money. And you know, it was cash flowing every month. And I was, you know, $200-$300 a month after all the expenses were paid and under great property management. It was a great little property. And then,
you know, go ahead.
Oh, no, I was just going to say. And then, Mike, I ran into the same issue that you did, which was the property taxes. Just, I was like, what? Because in a lot of states, you know, the property tax for owner occupants and residents is different from if you do not occupy the property. And I guess that the tax authority found out, obviously, that I was not living there. And the following year, when they redid the tax assessment, like the taxes went up almost, you know, I don't know, 150% or something like that, and really ate into the cash flow. And at that point, I was like, oh, well, now I'm just breaking even on the rent. So, eh. And then at that point, you know, I had had it for a couple of years. I think I had it for maybe 2 or 3 years. And then I sold it too at a profit. I had to put on a new roof and stuff. But I mean, I actually exited that property with money as well, which I did a 1031 exchange into something in the DC area. But Mike, you were going to say something.
No, I was just going to, you know, you mentioned the network. And so again, I don't know if I had ever actually been in South Carolina before.
Well, I haven't either. It makes you and me both, neither one of us have seen any of these houses.
So, but it doesn't mean we don't do our due diligence. When I was talking to the listing agent, he had given me the previous inspection report, which was old, and I was going to have to do a new one just so I could get a sense of what issues were there. And I you know, took photos of these supposed foundation issues. And I was like, I don't know anything about foundations. I went to biggerpockets.com, right? This website where people get together to talk about rentals and real estate. And I was like, where are my foundation experts at? And I was like, you know, these are some of the concerns people had. And I had experts, people even from the area who were like, those are cosmetic. Like, I wouldn't worry about it. And so that gave me enough confidence to go forward and say, okay, I'm going to get my own inspection. I'm going to have my own inspector go out there who's a specialist in foundations to make sure that there's no, you know, issues with that property. But, you know, without like creating that network, even informally, I didn't have to actually know these people. I just went online. I was really able to get a lot more confidence in what I was doing.
Yeah, it's really important, you know, like cast your network widely, because and even, you know, if you didn't have those people to tell you on BiggerPockets, you know, there's things like structural engineers and people, you know, that can go and take a look at properties. And in fact, those very same cracks, by the way, Mike, just to close the loop on this, I actually repaired before I sold it. So because,
really?
Yeah, because I was thinking back to when, you know, you had the inspection report and like saying that the first time homebuyers were all scared of it. I was like, And every time you see cracks in a foundation, people are like, oh my gosh, the house is going to fall into a big sinkhole, or, you know, whatever it is they're thinking. So I was like, I'm just going to repair these and not have it be an issue. Right. And sure enough, first people.
I remember the people who were looking to buy, they had a company come out, but it wasn't a company, a foundation company that is an unbiased third party, you know, analyst of those issues. It was a company that did foundation work. So they obviously had a conflict of interest. They had a bias towards saying work need to get done. And I saw the plans and they were going to install like 7 helical piers into the property. And I forget how many tens of thousands of dollars.
Yeah, no.
So that scared everybody away. So again, their loss was my gain just by doing a little bit of extra due diligence.
Awesome. So let's get into a topic that I think is something that you do really well, which is DIY landlording. Because I think most people in the Foreign Service, they are overseas. They do not want to worry about their property. They get a property management company, which, to be honest, the longer in life I go, the more I am valuing property management and the fact that it is no hassle at all. And the stuff that they take care of, I'm very happy for them to take care of. But you've done a different path. Talk to us a little bit about how you manage your properties from overseas.
Yeah, well, I will contradict you here a little bit. I don't think you may call it DIY. I truly feel that nothing that I do in property management is by myself. Mm-hmm. Because I can't do everything by myself. You know, sometimes halfway across the world. So it really does require a bit of a network. And I think people get scared by that term network, but it's really easy to conceptualize property management on your own when you kind of just think of things as like you're a conduit of information. So for example, like I manage the 3 properties that I have in the DC area. You know, by not using property management, I save about $750 a month, which is a considerable amount of money. Mm-hmm. Over what, like $9,000 a year.
Yeah.
And when I look back, when I do my taxes each year and I'm looking like all the expenses and, you know, remembering all the emails I got about whatever issues, you know, I look back and I think, you know, was it worth, you know, however much money I saved? And absolutely. And it depends on the asset class of the properties. You know, so I have the Alexandria property. I've had it since 2016. I've had 2 tenants in there since that time. Do you know how many phone calls I've gotten, or phone calls or emails? I don't really get phone calls, but how many emails I've gotten from the tenant about something? One. One. And it was an email from the tenant to say, hey, the faucet was broken and I went ahead and replaced it. That property rents for like $2,000 a month. That would be property management expenses of $200 a mm-hmm. month. Multiply that by 4 years. That's like $9,000 in costs I could have, you know, paid towards a property management company that I didn't have to, because, you know, I stepped a little bit out of my comfort zone early on and found out that, you know, property management isn't as difficult as it could be. And again, every property is different. I have some properties that are more problematic than others and require more attention. It all depends on the quality of the property and what you're comfortable doing. But really, it is kind of hands-off. You know, if a problem arises with a tenant, the first thing I do is I just respond immediately saying, thank you for the email. Let me look into this. Right? Good customer service. Mm-hmm. I don't know where you learned that from. But you don't have to have the answers right away. Mm-hmm. I mean, I don't know how to fix everything. So then you can start looking into, okay, what do I need to do to fix this issue? Or who do I need to contact to fix this issue? I'm not, you know, DIY property manager guy. I'm not replacing toilets anymore, even though I could. But I will overpay some plumber to go into my house and replace a toilet that I could do for $139 and 45 minutes of my time. But I will pay him $350 because that's what they're charging me. And you have to get a little bit zen about those kinds of things. But really, it's as hands on or hands off as you want it to be. And it's not nearly as scary as I think most people think it is. And it's frankly, Tanya, it's the number one thing that people ask me about whenever we talk about rentals and real estate.
Well, I think if you're saying that it saved you $9,000 and all you had to do was send one email to the tenant when their faucet broke. I mean, that's a pretty compelling argument, I'd say, right there, right? Don't you think also too that like the quality and the location where you're buying also has a lot to do with the amount of work that you get from the tenants? Because I find, I've got, properties in various economic areas, shall we say. And, granted, my Arlington property, it's the same thing. Like, I rarely hear from my tenants. I hear from them maybe once a year when something breaks. And I think that's also tied to oftentimes the price of the property and the socioeconomic conditions of the neighborhood, right? Because all of my Arlington properties, I mean, I would get the same thing. Like, the tenant would email me and be like, hey, I already picked up the faucet and it's replaced. Here's a picture. Here's the Home Depot receipt. You want to just send me, the Venmo me the money, easy, right? Whereas I have other places where, let's just say that doesn't happen. I don't want to out any of my tenants here, but let's say it's more difficult in other places.
There's totally a range, and you're right. So like that, generally speaking, the more you pay for property, theoretically you're getting a better location and things like that. You're, people are tend to be making more money. That's kind of the assumptions, but I will tell you the spectrum can flip on the other end. If your property is very nice, you get people who are very demanding and very much require a lot of your time and attention and want things the way they want it. And frankly, they should. Mm-hmm. I mean, if somebody's paying, some properties in the Arlington area, in DC, they're, $4,000-$6,000 a month. And so they, I think, have a right to expect a certain quality of home, and that makes sure that everything's working. But you're totally right. And I remember I was looking at properties in Charleston a long time ago, South Carolina. And this was back in the day. Zillow like lost this functionality, but this is how I used to look for properties. You could turn on a function for sale and then also for rent. And then you could have different sliding scales for each of those. And then it would essentially tell me where the pockets.
Interesting. I didn't know Zillow used to do that. I wonder why they took that feature off.
Yeah. But it allowed me to know where basically my 1% properties are, essentially like where are my $150,000 properties that are also renting for about $1,500 a month. And so I could see groupings like in little neighborhoods, and it's not common. It's not common. And so I would reach out to people, realtors, and be like, can you tell me a little bit about this area? And more often than not, they would say, look, it cash flows, but it's going to require more of your time as a property owner to address the details. You might have to deal with, late payments and things like that. A lot of people make a lot of money doing landlording properties like that. That's not something I have gravitated toward. It's not something I want to. Like a lot of people, I got a day job, so I can't spend all my time stressing out about things like that.
Since you manage your properties from overseas, how do you do rent collection? It sounds like, you receive emails from tenants when there's a problem, and then you address it from where you are, wherever that happens to be in the world, by like contacting vendors and then just sort of organizing the logistics directly with the vendor and the tenant, right? What do you do for rent collection? What do you do for things like, like inclement weather is coming? Do you tell the tenants? Do you do any kind of like proactive stuff? I know one cool thing that I know you do, because I've seen some of your properties, is Mike's got this house handbook, if you will, of, I'll let you explain. Why don't you talk? Because this is something that I don't often see that landlords do. And I think it's a really cool thing.
Yeah, sure. So, I'll just mention quickly the places, the websites I use for automated online electronic debt,
rent collection.
Rent mm-hmm. collection. So I used to do Cozy, and Cozy was super easy, cozy.co, but apartments.com bought them. And so they did like this transition this last year or
and
so.
And it has not been so great. Nope.
Yeah, it's a little wonky. Plus apartments.com just sounds a little eh. So I still have two properties in which people are paying through apartments.com. But I also started toying with recently, and I have one tenant on this, Rentler. And again, I went online just to see reviews of what, you know, property managers were using. And Rentler has been pretty good. And the best thing that I'd heard about Rentler, and I'm going to have a conversation with my tenant about this in a little while, is that the tenant said that the interface was easier than other things they've used. And so, you know, my goal is to make sure people live in a place that, you know, they enjoy, and then to make the whole renting process as easy as possible.
Yes, especially paying money, right? You don't want it to be hard for people to pay you the rent. Is Rentler free for landlords, or is it a like a fee for per month?
You know, I believe it's free. If it costs anything, it might be $1.99, which I'm not going to stress about. Again, I got to get Zen about those expenses.
I think $1.99 is fine. It's like the least expensive thing ever in real estate that you'll ever pay for, right? I mean,
yeah. But going back to weather, so like, and I just, as we're recording this, there's like a, I think a second storm on its way to
right,
DC,
I know. So. We just got some snow last night.
I do say, like, you know, for the South Carolina properties, it's like, okay, hurricanes. You know, I purposely bought property that was a little bit higher elevation. I thought about that, no flood insurance. But then for the DC properties, you know, whenever there's weather, I do try and think about what goes on. So for example, I got a property in Hyattsville, Maryland, and that property has shown a tendency, a propensity to flood, which nobody wants flooding. And so part of it might just be because the drain in the walkout basement stairwell is, you know, clogged with leaves. So, you know, I may send a note like, hey, you know, please make sure the drain is free so that the water doesn't pool up and then overflow into the basement or something. I don't think about it too much, but it does. Whenever I hear about hurricanes, I think about my property in South Carolina. And then kind of related to weather, just in some weird tangential way, that the book you mentioned is a quick reference guide. So this is, it's like a 2-page document. I have one for each of my properties that I manage. And after we sign and after the tenant moves in, right, they sign the lease, nobody reads the lease. But what I'll do is I'll include in this quick reference sheet key information I want them to have, and that may also reiterate the important things from the lease from my perspective. So first, as like my contact information, and I try to always respond extremely quickly to email so people aren't stressed out. I also have a list of like preferred vendors. And I always say like, I want to know what's getting fixed before it gets fixed so I can approve it. But if something comes up, like, these are the people. I also have contact info for like all the utilities, like what day of the week the garbage is picked up, like, you know, how you set up the accounts, where the electrical box is and the main water shutoff valve. But I also have in there a section on what to do if. And that's really just like in case of emergency, right? If there's a gas leak, if the house is on fire, if somebody drives through the front of home. I am the last person you should be
and
calling.
And they call Mike. They do. They're like, what should I do? And I'm like, get out of the house. Like, don't be in there. Like, don't be calling me. Like, get out of the house. Like, no.
Like, but so these things don't happen often, but if it's an emergency, call the authorities. So that's my thing. If it's an emergency or there's massive flooding, call somebody. I should not be your first call. You know, other than that, honestly, like little things pop up with homes, but it's not a ton of stuff. And it's usually like, oh, hey, this has been broken for 2 weeks. Like, can we fix this? And it's like, okay, well, if it's been broken for 2 weeks, it's not a high priority for you, but I will try and address it as soon as possible. So rarely does anybody bring something to my attention that is like after hours, like you hear these stories about like, oh, floods or toilets.
Yeah, you know, the legendary 2 a.m. toilet call or whatever it is that landlords have to deal with.
never had. Not that it doesn't happen, but it, you know, fires do happen. I've got a crazy fire story. It's not mine, but it's unbelievable. It's crazy. Makes you want to rethink real estate. But also in that quick reference guide, I have friendly reminders that are just like, you know, payments due on this day. Please lock the doors. Depending on the property, like the county requires you to shovel after snow. If it does, for example, garbage picked up on whatever day, like please replace light bulbs and little things like that. But it's just kind of like once they've settled into the property, then I kind of sent, you know, a couple of days later, I send it to them so they can kind of acclimate and they're not all stressed out by their own move. And then they have a kind of like a good base of knowledge of what to do in certain situations.
I think that's really smart because I have definitely gotten those phone calls of like, I think there's a gas leak, Tanya. And I'm like, why are you calling me? Like, please get out of the house and call the gas company, you know, but they don't know. And I think and it was funny because I want to say it was last year we had like some crazy weather and one of the tenants texts me at, you know, and I'm in Florida at the time and she's like, I think a tree fell on the house. And I'm like, oh gosh, are you okay? She's like, no, I think it's fine. She's like, I think, and I'm just that kind of stuff. You know, when you're not there, I'm like, can you send me some photos? And so sure enough, she sends me this photo of this like ginormous tree that literally missed the house by 2 inches. I kid you not.
Oh my
yeah,
God.
And it was a neighbor's tree. And then, you know, all these fun things about like, okay, so who's going to pay for the tree? Whose fault is it? Are we calling insurance? Like, you know, luckily, I mean, it kind of scraped the house as it was going down, but it didn't do any damage. Like, luckily, I was really shocked and, you know, happy, obviously, that it didn't. But the tenants were all kind of spooked about it because they thought, well, what if it fell on the house? And I was like, well, it didn't. So, okay. But yeah, they call me about that. And I'm like, I don't know what I'm going to be doing about this kind of tree when I'm in Florida. But okay. You know, that's their first call, I guess, is the landlord.
Yeah, I feel like the funny thing is like, even if it's like the first time you have faced this issue, whether it's a landlord or as a tenant, but like the moment like a plumber comes to a house and there's a massive flood, they're cool and calm about it. Like they've done that a million times. It's because these things happen. Like nothing can happen to your property that hasn't happened like hundreds of thousands and not millions
true,
of times before
true,
in other
yes.
properties across the country. There's nothing unique is really going to happen to your house.
Have you ever had any issues with eviction? Because I think that's another area where people get freaked out. Like, well, if they're just squatting and they're not paying, like, what do I do? Right?
Yeah. So I think that goes back again to the asset class that you're investing in. I haven't had eviction issues. If going back to this, my Denver condo, which is where my wife likes to make fun of me. I think I had two tenants who bailed in like the middle of the night. And it wasn't like, I would prefer that any day over like a squatter.
True. Somebody, like there and not paying rent, refusing to leave.
Mm-hmm. But I haven't done that. And I think I would not, that can happen kind of in any asset class, but I probably wouldn't buy into an asset class where I thought that was a possibility.
I'm curious. You are in 3 different states now. Do you find that there is much of a difference in terms of return among the states or the type of property that you're investing in, or does it just kind of depend? What's kind of been the winners in your portfolio and maybe not the losers, but like the less profitable places, right?
So I guess like define profit. Mm-hmm. And if we're talking about like cash on cash, like monthly cash in your pocket, that's one thing. But then if you're looking at appreciation, you know, that is like cash on paper that you're not realizing yet.
Yeah.
But if you have the means to kind of make it through, you know, live below your means, do your day job, and over time, that appreciation that you can realize later on is going to be so much greater. So, you know, it's tough. So like Arlington, I think people know it's difficult. I wouldn't say it's impossible, but Northern Virginia, it's extremely difficult to find a place that is going to cash flow and cash flow a decent amount, but you will see the appreciation. You know, we've been looking a lot in Maryland lately. Maryland gives you really good rents, surprisingly high rents, even compared to Arlington. And the cost of homes there is not so much. And you have lots of infrastructure, mm-hmm. like, you know, metros. You know this, Tanya. I'm kind of like obsessed with metros. I want my properties close to metros. I want a big lot close to metros, and I want a walkout basement. Those are like my things. I think long term, I want to hold these properties long term. That's my goal. So it's kind of like different. And I found in Maryland, for example, I think because, you know, DC is expanding out and Maryland's ripe for that expansion, I feel like Maryland gives a good mix of both cash flow. So I can feel good about the property and I'm never stressed. But then also I do think, you know, appreciation, you know, is there.
Yeah, I'd agree, you know, because I think, you know, I invested in Florida and in Texas and in South Carolina outside of the DC area. And all 3 of those places, I've sold all of my properties there, and mostly because of the property taxes, but also because of the insurance too. Like in South Carolina and in Florida, because of the hurricane insurance, the premiums just kept going up and up and up. And, you know, for those people who don't have homestead or they don't own or occupy, the taxes are just sometimes. I remember my property in San Antonio, I want to say that it was like, I can't remember exactly, but it was like 2 or 3 months of the rent just went to taxes. And I was like, this is, even if I paid the property mortgage down to 0, I would still be paying that rent to, you know, in property taxes every year. And so no matter what I did, like the money that I had invested in those properties, they just weren't giving a great return just because the property taxes were so high, even though the properties were great, right? One thing I do like about outside of the DC area is it's easier to find places that have been built, you know, like since 2000, let's just say, that are not really, you know, a lot older. And in DC, you can find them. You do have to go out in the suburbs. And, you know, I'm a big fan of Maryland too, for that reason, for investment property, because you can find newer things, you know, if you don't stay by metro, let's just say. But, you know, I think the great thing about investing is there really is something for everyone. And you have to decide what kind of investor you are. Are you, you know, some people don't want 10 properties. Some people only want 1 or 2, and they just want to squirrel away, you know, it's kind of like a forced savings plan in a very high appreciating market like Northern Virginia. And they just want to sit on their one or two properties. And in 30 years, they're going to be sitting on, you know, quite a handsome sum. And other people want the cash flow now because they'd like to leave their job. And that's going to help them do that. Or, you know, they want a second stream of income in addition to their job so that maybe they can, you know, retire faster or, you know, do FIRE or whatever it is they want to do. So I think that's the beauty of the United States. Lots of places to invest, right? So any last words for our listeners, tips, advice you'd give them if they're considering doing some of the things that you've done or any mistakes maybe you've made that you want to share? You know, sometimes we learn more from our mistakes than you know, the things we did right. But curious, any advice you want to share?
Tanya, mistakes, right? Like I can't tell you how many mistakes. So, but here's the deal. This is what I've really learned. And, you know, I learned this with Denver property. You know, if you have a long-term horizon and you're holding onto a property long-term, there are extremely few mistakes that you can make that are really going to hurt that investment big time. I mean, I think the two things are, you know, if you pay way too much for property, and I think people who think they paid too much for property, I'm actually talking about way more than that. You know, you're paying an extra 5% over asking. Like, I don't think that's crazy. If you get the financing wrong, I think that can really hurt you, especially if you're going to be looking at, you know, cash flow and things like that. And I've made both of these mistakes, but I've learned from them, and both the properties I held on to, and guess what? Everything's okay. So you're going to make mistakes, and really there's not that many mistakes you can make that, again, will destroy the investment. But the big things, the two tips that I would, first and foremost, if you're going to rent things out, you're looking at property management. What I would say is try managing yourself first. Try it out. The property management companies are always going to be there to pick up the pieces if you just can't get your crap together and it's just too hard, or, you know, life happens, right? And maybe some of the things I manage now, I'll in the future throw a property management company on it just because I'm, you know, maybe something else is going on. So, but I wish it can try to get people to just try it. You know, once you get past that tenant placement and, you know, what I'll call the settling in period, where you kind of figure out the quirks and tweaks of, you know, the property and the person's needs, things tend to be smooth sailing. So I try to get people to just try it on their own. And it's tough because, again, people think that they need to know everything ahead of time. Again, that's not true. And I will tell you that, but the biggest, most important thing that I would tell people, and I tell this to everyone, is that if you're looking at purchasing rental properties or primary residence that you would like to rent out in the future, you really need to work with an agent that is currently investing in the markets where you are looking. And I can't tell you the number of times I've talked to realtors, I've worked with realtors where they have been investor friendly. Or said, and looking back, I think we're probably lying, that they had their own investment properties and they didn't. And that really hurt me because I need an investor agent who is going to sift through all those properties and send me the good ones. Otherwise, I'm going to be spending hours sifting through, you know, properties that, you know, I'm getting, you know, secondary from the MLS. So it takes a lot of time. But if you get somebody who knows what they're doing, who is currently investing in the area, they can sift through all the crap, frankly, and they can send you the properties that make sense. And then the second thing, and this is one of the most important things, is that agent that's currently investing in that market is going to have a wide network that you can build on. You know, that realtor should not be the person that helps you close and then is gone till the next time you buy a property or purchase another one. They have so many resources that you can go to. And I've seen people look at rental properties with maybe a realtor that they bought their primary residence with, and not saying that agents who help people buy their primary residence can't also do investing, but sometimes they don't have that expertise and people default to them just because they were nice and they like the home. But really, if you are looking strictly at a rental property, the biggest piece of advice I can give you is find an agent that's currently investing in that market who can help you sift through all the crap and give you referrals.
Awesome. Mike, we have really enjoyed having you on the show, and good luck with the rest of your investment portfolio. And we look forward to, like, big things. I don't know what you have planned next, if you're going to still invest in Northern Virginia, but best of luck and thanks so much.
Thanks so much, Tanya. Appreciate being on.
If you like this episode and want more, make sure to give us 5 stars on the podcast player of your choice. And after that, check out our Facebook page. From there, you can learn about our other episodes, connect with our guests, and of course, share your own ideas for success. We'll See you next time.